loved, which is identified with Christian perfection, is God. Now, as we mentioned, the difference really between Aquinas and Bellarmine is the difference of the span of 5 centuries. In the meantime, during the late Middle Ages and for a couple of 100 years before the Reformation, there had developed in Christian thought an attention and concentration on Christ, which is a phenomenon that should be known. It is no wonder, for example, that the Protestant Reformers should have made so much of Christ. They were the inheritors of that tradition. When Ignatius then came along and developed his whole spirituality in terms of the following of Christ, of which, of course, there was the warrant already in a campus, you have a fully rounded Christian spirituality. The object, therefore, that which is loved in terms of Christian perfection is God, or now, as recognized in all Catholic writings, and in fact all Christian writings, the object of that love is not really God in heaven, or God in, you might say, in his Trinitarian nature, but God in the person of Christ. This has, if you can speak of it, revolutionized Christian spirituality. And I say that with emphasis. And those who are familiar with many of these concepts may not be so struck by it, because it is the atmosphere in which we now breathe. It is not the atmosphere of 500 years, say, before the Reformation. While the person of Christ was there, the attention on Christ as the model of perfection simply isn't there. I find called the Summa, and found very little, I think just one part of a question, a small part, on Christ as the exemplary cause, as the pattern, as the model for Christian perfection. The virtues themselves are structured in terms of God, God as the Trinity. Anyhow, it simplifies, of course, just to add a point again, it simplifies Christian spirituality, because now the love of God can be terminally in the person of Christ, and by loving that man, believing he is God, you are loving God. The secondary object, secondary because it is subordinate to the primary love, which is that of God in the person of Christ, is both oneself and one's neighbor. It is incorrect, therefore, to suppose that the secondary object of the love of God is loving of one's neighbor. No. It's the love of every rational creature besides God, including oneself. Now, by secondary, it means the motive for loving even oneself or and one's neighbor should be the love of God. A question may arise, how can I intelligently or intelligibly love myself and yet be said to be loving God with a perfect love? Isn't there a kind of built-in dichotomy or contradiction? Well, no. Provided I love myself as God wants me to love myself, I am loving, now watch this, I am loving God perfectly, even in loving self. Because after all, loving God is not an abstraction. It's not a word or a mere sentiment. It's a reality. And if I love God the way he wants me to manifest that love by loving myself, my love can be perfect. And when the question arises, can I therefore desire heaven or the reward for my loving God? Is that consonant with the perfect love of God? Yes. Does it mean then that I don't have to exclude the desire for heaven from the perfect love of God? Don't have to, I can't. Because if God wants me to be saved, to enjoy myself in heaven, my desiring that which he wants is the perfect love. Now, it's true. Concretely, in any given instance, I may, now there's a supplement, I may transmit, I may, as it were, ignore, I may not pay attention to, psychologically, the benefit that is accruing to me by seeing my perfect love of God, foreseeing so that I'm going to be benefited. Very well, psychologically, I may prescind from that. Nevertheless, objectively, I am always benefited, even when I perfectly love God, albeit we define the perfect love of God as excluding self. Now, the exclusion means that my psychological motivation is not that of self-benefit. This is crucial. It is that objectively I cannot eliminate self-benefit, self-profit, by my perfect love of God. Because God rewards those who love Him, and the more perfectly I love Him, the more He rewards me. So I cannot say that I don't want to be rewarded. If I did that, I would be going against God's will, who wants me to be rewarded. But between dominant motive and objective fact is all the difference between motivation and what actually happens. Anyhow, I can love even myself, certainly others, while loving God perfectly. Notice we are subordinating all this to the perfect love of God. Know the acts of this love, and this is where it becomes concrete. First of all, this Christian perfection about which the saints, and these are the three that we are specially considering, when they spoke of loving God perfectly, they distinguished, and here it is particularly Aquinas who distinguishes between affective and effective. He theoretically, and then Ignatius and Bellarmine after them, or after him, very practically. A person can be loved either affectively or effectively, meaning what? Yeah. Affectively, when he is loved with my affections, and that essentially is what love is. In other words, my will desires that person's benefit. I love him. And in the absence of that, the effective love, of course, is impossible. On the other hand, for us, say for human beings, in fact for anyone, to just love affectively in the sense of loving in the affections without effectuating, doing something about that, beyond and outside of the mere pure internal will act, makes that internal affection suspect. In fact, it won't last. In fact, it isn't there. Really, of course, love is always a composite. If I love someone, I do something about it. I don't just down deep inside have a warm feeling. If that's all I've got, I don't even have that. It may have been a good breakfast that I ate. Now, what is the affective love of God? Remember, we're talking about perfect love, a kind of love, in other words, which rises above the desire for self-advantage. There are three, recognize this is mainly St. Thomas. These three. The first is joy and complacency. Now, the terms are technical, and as I mentioned before, we could spend a whole course on justice. I did, in fact, and I do teach a seminar. It was a 4-week seminar on this subject, so we can't say everything. But at least, the first response internally, when I love God perfectly, as when I love anyone selflessly, is one of joy and complacency. In other words, I rejoice in what this person possesses. Just to be in that person's company is enough. Just to think about him or her is enough. Now, this, of course, is essential in the case of God, because we cannot, strictly speaking, go on to benefit God, which is the usual next step in love. In other words, the joy that I have, the joy that we read about in the mystics, the pleasure, the satisfaction that anyone gets from recognizing who God is, and as it were, reveling in that realization. It means negatively, and this is of some moment, especially in terms of modern philosophy, it means that I am pleased with what God possesses. I don't envy him his divinity. And if that sounds strange, then you do not know modern philosophy. If there is anything in modern philosophy in terms of, say, admission or denial of a personal God, it is the scandal at recognizing, admitting, and not questioning the existence of a being who is all perfect, and who is to such an extent sovereign master of his creatures that they obey his will, and he can actually set the conditions for their destiny. Against that, the natural man rebels, and the perfect love of God recognizes, because God, after all, is a composite of all attributes, recognizes his justice, his power, his sovereignty, his beauty and wisdom and all the rest, and rejoices in God's possession of that, doesn't either question or much less envy that he, in Homer's terms, like the gods, sitting complacently the immortal ones in the imperial regions and allowing us poor mortals to suffer. That's Homer in 800 BC, the natural man. Not to envy God his joy, and not to begrudge our creaturehood, is the deepest sentiment that a human being can have towards God. It is also the strongest temptation. I like to think of it as the only temptation to which a creature is really subject. Secondly, going beyond the internal satisfaction with God for what he is zealous desire as of the second internal affective act. Now, desire, of course, means that I want to somehow do something, and in this case, I want to do something for the God whom I love. If the one whom I loved were a human being, I should try to do something for him or her. Of roses, box of candy, a new tie, you name it. But where it is God, and he cannot, of course, be benefited in any way, whatever my desires in God's relation are, they cannot be to make God more godlike. That would be something. If we somehow improved on God, we cannot make him more happy. We cannot make him richer. We cannot add in any way to what he's got to begin with, whatever we give him to actually be his in the first place, so he'd have it before we even thought of giving it to him. Yet there is a sense in which, as we will see when we take up the second stage, the effective love, there is a desire as far as possible to give God that alone which he wants. You see, as we mentioned before, there's a difference between wanting and needing. And that is not a subtlety. God needs nothing. He wants a lot of things. Now, the thing that he most wants is, and we're just indulging in all kinds of technical terms, without apology for explaining, because this is not the place for it. Better time. It is the place, but not the time. What he most wants, of course, is to be glorified, which means to be known and loved by his creatures. In fact, in the last analysis, that's all he wants. But that's everything. That's why he made the world. Even the irrational part of the world, so that the rational part might use things that are irrational to rise to a better knowledge and love of Him. And if I truly love God, this is internally, then I desire as far as possible to somehow answer that need to give God what He wants. The desire must be there. And thirdly, still on the internal affective level, there is sorrow or sadness over sin. These are the three principal responses of a loving heart. Meaning that if I love God, as even in human relations, and I see Him offended, or I saw Him, know that He has been offended by sin, by those who reject His will, who reject His love, who are ungrateful, well, I'm sad. And not to be so is really not to love God. If someone whom I love is hurt in any way, and I don't feel sad about it, to the extent to which I don't feel sad, I don't love. And consequently, this is an internal, still an internal sentiment. The external expression we'll see in a moment. That sadness, and of course it is such which we dwell upon in the lives of the saints, is sensed and somehow is at the heart of all true sorrow for sin. A sadness that a person has offended a God who's been so good. Now on the effective level. Effectively, as distinguished from affectively, means to love not only with internal sentiment, which is essential, with the will, but that the will does something about that love. As we mentioned before, if there is no effect to affection, the affection either isn't there or isn't what it claims to be. There are two ways in which this perfect love of God is effectively shown, and this is particularly clear in Bellarmine, following Ignatius. The first is laboring for God's glory. So in other words, if the affection is that I desire to enhance God's glory by making Him known and loved, I effectively show that by working, that men might know and love Him. And of course, that begins with myself. Behind that statement stands all, I wish to underline, italicize and capitalize, stands all the efforts of everyone who claims that he loves God, even if he doesn't know it. If he loves God, that's why he's doing it. That God might be better known and more loved. And you see how the whole realm of knowledge, including so-called secular knowledge, fits into the pattern. It especially means it is behind all the effort for evangelism, of apostolic zeal, because it is possible, as is obvious, for people not to know God or not to love Him. In my effort to increase that knowledge, if one more person comes to know and love God more than he would have except for my efforts, I consider my efforts well spent. It is this concept which those of you that are familiar with this what do those four words, letters mean? Ad maiorem Dei gloriam. Now that's Latin, of course. Ad maiorem Dei gloriam. To the greater glory of God. Glory always means knowledge and love. A person is glorified when I recognize, say, his qualities, his perfections, and I praise him for what he's got. In terms of God, it is the recognition of God for what he is and praising him for his possessions. And in terms, therefore, this, by the way, is the motto of the Society of Jesus, which Bellarmine expatiated on for great many pages. Now the crucial word there is the second one, maiorem, greater. In other words, it is possible for God to receive more or less of this recognition and love. And it depends on the cooperation of his creatures, of how much he is going to be known and loved. And except for the efforts of others, people simply wouldn't come to that knowledge and love of God, which alone is what God wants. Finally, this is on the effective level. We said there were two. Laboring for God's glory, laboring that men might know, come to know and love God. The more people know, the more people love, the greater his glory. Secondly, and this is correlative with the business of sorrow for sin, some kind of reparation is made, some kind of making up, so to speak, expiation for sin. In other words, in terms of some kind of, and the word bristles, some kind of penance, some kind of self-sacrifice, some kind of self-imposition, or at least acceptance of God's pains or what he sends as an expiation for sin. And Augustine has that very pregnant phrase, sin and suffering are the law of existence. Where there is sin, there must always be suffering. And then he says, you have the choice. Either God causes you the suffering, or you cause it yourself. In other words, either you accept from God what he sends, or if you don't, he's going to punish you. Because having been sinners, and we being sinners, suffering is the correlative of sin. Either God does it, even against our will, and either in this life or in the next, or we willingly accept from his hands the sufferings that he sends as a punishment for sin. And the saints we know went way beyond in that. And it is tied in with that, going beyond, which is also part of what we saw in our last class, the business of the councils. So that when we said that going beyond what a man has to do, that he will even do things which he may do, which please, say God, and we identify that, this is now Bellarmine's terminology, we identify that with the desire, the acceptance, and even search for that which is harder, just because it is harder, no, but because that's what Christ did. Now behind that, why did Christ do it? To expiate sin. And the moment it clicks in the human mind, and I've seen it click in people's minds, suffering and sin, the moment that clicks, their lives are changed. Because the only problem we've got in life is suffering. It's an impossible one. Everything else pleases us. That's how it is. We're satisfied with everything else. Life is wonderful, except for the suffering, except for the pain. Well, as I say, the moment a person realizes that in the mind of God, in objective reality, that suffering is connected with sin, mine and somebody else's, then the life is changed. Because then suffering and pain become meaningful. And they become meaningful not only in the sense that I accept for my own sins, which I may complacently think don't deserve this kind of suffering, but at least and always the sins of others. And no one person can suffer enough, if he knows his theology, to expiate the sins of other men. There's always more sin to expiate. A whole theology behind it. In fact, a whole system of Christianity stands behind it. Finally, the conditions. This is straight Thomas. What are the requisite conditions? This, notice, is different than acts. Act is what I do. The conditions are you might say, the circumstances which enable me to do these things that I'm supposed to do, that I do when I love God. It is that which leads up to the preambles, the background, the backlog, the foundation. Pardon the synonyms. The first is, so Aquinas says, remember what we're talking about. We're talking about, how do I get this love of God? Beautiful, sublime. What do you do about it? How do you get there? The first is, the memory of God's benefits, and to me, beginning with to me. If I want to love God, I will never get there unless I become conscious of God's goodness to me. Memory and reflection on God's goodness to me. For the simple reason that I cannot psychologically love anyone except for a motive above himself, unless that person has somehow been good to me. I can rise above that, but then I'm doing more than psychology. Psychologically, I love the lovable. I am grateful to the good, and I'm good to those who are good to me. And consequently, other things being equal, there are four conditions, other things being equal, I will love God to the degree to which I realize how good he has been and good to me. And any preoccupation, for example, with my badness, my sinfulness, my wickedness, there's plenty there, must always be balanced with the reflection of not how good I am, but how good God has been to me and what he's given to me. And why? Because the first condition for loving God is gratitude. I can never begin to love God unless I am first grateful to him. And I won't be grateful unless I know what I'm grateful for. Secondly, reflection on God's greatness. Now this doesn't mean just his power, but all his infinite qualities. Wisdom, his power, his beauty. And thus a man like Ignatius, for example, could walk through a field and see the flowers of the field and be wrapped in ecstasy. Now it is well to know the function of all these things in creatures, in creation. Its purpose is to raise the mind from the mundane to the Creator who made them. How beautiful must be the Creator if even the things that he made can be so ravishingly beautiful. So that men will sell kingdoms for a beautiful face. They're mad in doing it. That's not the point. The point is that if a creature can so ravish, what must be the Creator who has made beauty itself, in fact, who is beauty? Thirdly, detachment from creatures. This was taught by Aquinas, but especially has been developed in Ignatius to a point where it looks almost excessive. In other words, if I want to love God, if I want to draw closer to the love of God, I must draw away from that kind of love of creatures which stands between God and me. It doesn't mean that I'm not going to love creatures, but that I'm not going to love them in such a way or beyond or longer than he is consonant with my love of God. Now this detachment is a subtle thing. Again, we just cannot dwell on it as we could for hours on what this means. But basically it means that I am able to let go of everything less than God the moment God's will is involved. Learning to let go, in fact, being able to let go. In other words, if a person, say, loves somebody, and that other person is asking him or her to do something which is wrong, so far, no further. Or if, say, a person is to do his duty, and the duty calls for his breaking up a piece of work at 5 o'clock. If he goes beyond to 5:10, he's cheating. He is, in other words, he is more involved or more attached to the creature than he is to God, if God's will says so much and no more. And this especially, of course, refers to ourselves, because the one that we love most among creatures, barring none, is ourselves. So that I don't love my own will. And among the things that people find most difficult to give up is not just their own will, but their own mind. That's the core, that's the heart. If God's will says that this is the truth and I don't see it, but God says it's true, I let go. That's hard. In fact, the longer I live, the more minds I deal with. This, I think, is the great sacrifice of the human spirit demanded by Christianity. The sacrifice of the mind. Finally, avoidance of sin, which in a way is what we've been saying before, except that it's more crucial now. Namely, that if I love God, I avoid sin. And the more I avoid sin, the more I shall love it. And consequently, a soul that is stained even with minor faults, little things, little unkindnesses, and so on, to that extent has not yet learned to love God perfectly. Avoidance of sin and the effort, therefore, to avoid sin is a mark of one who loves God and wants to grow in that love. These four, therefore, are the conditions. And with that, much as I'd like to, we'll follow the curtain on a subject that is highly delectable and carries with it the essence of the faith. But are there any questions before we go? Yes, sister.
Father, this last statement that you made, the great sacrifice.
We can distinguish, among others, there are any number of stages within these, but at least three major stages in both the nature of civil society and the theology reflecting on it, from the death of Christ, which is about 37 AD, up to modern times. The first stage would certainly be the period of original foundation of the church, and the life, you might say, under persecution, under duress. That is, the church was under duress. Well, for all practical purposes, the state was the dominant pagan state, and you don't have any theology to speak of, because there was really no state to talk about beyond the state that was submerging and suppressing Christianity. Nevertheless, already during this time, you find certain basic concepts of the state, first in Scripture and then in the Fathers, which show that, as Augustine later on pointed out, no one more than a Christian respects civil society, since nobody else but a Christian would have put up with, so Augustine says, whether a Christian suffered at the hands of civil authority for 300 years. They would have rebelled long before. And Augustine, as we will point out, uses this as one of the proofs for Christianity's being more than a natural religion. A natural man just doesn't take it that way. Anyhow, in terms of theology, that's about it, because civil society by that time had not yet become, as we know, directly related to or integrated with Christian principles. The second long stage, which might, in some writers, as a matter of fact, be called the Middle Ages. Now, that's a long Middle Ages. From 313 to 1517. At any rate, from the time that the Edict of Constantine, the Edict of Milan, was published, the emancipating Christians, and allowing them, as you remember, under Constantine, parallel freedom with the pagan religion. This is something forgotten, I think, often. It wasn't that Christianity suddenly became the dominant religion. No. Christians, along with pagans, were given their freedom of practice and freedom of worship. 3:13. Immediately there developed, first of all, practical relationships, and then a whole library of theology on the nature of civil society and on the relationship of church to state. Those 1,200 years was covered pretty much what we are covering. That's what we're trying to do in our three great men, and really inaugurate or usher in modern times. 1517, which of course is the opening of the Protestant Reformation, up to the present, is the era, among other things, of the secular state. Both a national church and a secular state. We too often, or rather too seldom, correlate the two. So, either a national church, as say in the Scandinavian countries, in Denmark, and much of Germany, and of course in England, or the secular state in other countries, and in fact even in those, as and when the church steps up. This creates brand new problems, and for those, as we will see, Bellarmine's principles, he after all lived a good 100 years in this so-called modern era, died in 1621, by which time he saw not only what was going to, but what already had taken place. National churches had organized, deism had come into existence, and so many of the concepts that we know face, pluralistic society, divergent religions, state dominating church, and so on, those are things that Bellarmine took cognizance of. Augustine, therefore, and Aquinas will give us a purview of the theology within, you might say, the harmony of church and state as found in medieval society, and Bellarmine laying down the principles for modern civil society principles and the relationship of the state to the church. Now let's begin immediately with the Augustinian contribution. I asked you to read certain sections in the quotations we've got, and you find some very fine passages there. But the sources are mainly three, and among the three, the most important single one, of course, is the City of God, the Civitate Dei of St. Augustine. Two books that I commend to your reading sometime, at least in your ambitious future, are The City of God and The Confessions of Augustine. Now, The City of God need not be read in toto. You don't have to read every word to profit from it. Especially the first few chapters you can well skip or skim over. But The City of God is the master treatise. First of all, it's the most mature work of Augustine, the last big thing he published, and at great length, very great length, describes the nature of civil society, the relationship of church and state, and so many things that we will have as we go through. However, his both treatises and letters, but especially his major treatises against the Donatists, have a lot of theology on the nature of civil society. Why? Because, as you know, first of all, the Donatists had got, if not approval, at least permission from the state to propagate themselves. And then dramatically, before he died, Augustine changed his attitude, and from saying that we should, well, preach to them and pray for them, he said, things have got too far, gone too bad, let's call in the state. Augustine's attitude towards the state in controlling and even in removing the evils as he saw them caused by the Donatist schism are one of the features of his anti-Donatist writings. Secondly, his letters, especially the Donatist period, but not only. Not a small amount of his correspondence was with civil princes. And there you find many of his ideas that we're going to briefly outline. Finally, and as we mentioned before, most importantly, The City of God is the treatise. In fact, I'd say it still stands as the greatest single work on relationship of church and state in Christian thought. Yes?
Mm-hmm. In your, Augustine advocated using the state against the government.
Yes. Yes.
Because they, the nuns, listen, I mean, it was a surprise to me when I first read it, but they really ganged up just the way the Southern people are doing, some of them, on these...
It was getting impossible. And in other words, by that token, might you should be scandalized, as some people are, of course, at the Supreme Court's decision in Congress now passing the Civil Rights Law, which is exactly, well, barring the shift of 16 centuries, same idea.
Well, let me clarify exactly what the Donatists were doing.
Let's get into my own. We got that clear. All right, now some of the contributions of Augustine. Insights. We've got 7. We could have made it 17. And once you see this, you wonder what else anybody else could say. Well, they said much more. For one thing, Augustine did not anticipate our modern secular state. First of all, Augustine, especially in the City of God, the early part points out the dramatic change inaugurated by the teachings of Christ on there being a civil society at all, which is distinct somehow from ecclesiastical authority. In other words, and correctly, he points out that prior to the coming of Christianity, there was no real distinction ever made, except verbally, between, say, religion and society, or institutionally, church and state. Even among the Jews, David, Solomon, and the rest were in many ways prophets. And they were those who were rulers of the people, even in things spiritual, certainly, say, in Rome or Greece. The Pontifex Maximus, the emperor, was also the great priest, the Sacerdos Magnus. Well, they identified the two, in fact, as we know, among the Romans, they even deified the emperors. But with the coming of Christianity, and specifically with the teachings of Christ, and more specifically still, the occasion when Christ was approached, as you recall, by the Pharisees and asked whether tribute should be paid to Caesar, and instead of directly answering yes or no, if he said yes, he would have made enemies with the Jews who said no. If he said no, he would have been against the Romans who said yes. Instead, he asked for a coin and asked whose inscription it was. They said Caesar's, and then rendered the thing to Caesar, the things that are Caesar's, and to God, the things that are God's. Now, the significant thing is that he should have said things that are Caesar's. In other words, there was an autonomous authority. There are certain things that belong to Caesar, which Christ distinguished from the things that belong to God. That is the first time in civilized society that you had a clear distinction between two separate societies. Now, with that, of course, also came numerous problems, not the least of which being to distinguish what belongs to Caesar. How far may you go? Now, Augustine points out that along with Christ's teachings on there being two distinct societies, we have the teaching of Paul and Peter on all authority, if it's legitimate, being from God. And he waxes eloquent for chapters in describing the Roman persecutions of the Christians and asks every once in a while, he breaks, who else but Christians would have taken it? Not just sitting down, but lying down, being beheaded, crucified, devoured by lions, and because if they had wanted to, they might have rebelled against the state, caused all kinds of trouble. Instead, they quite literally turn the other cheek. Anyhow, Augustine points out that Christianity, therefore, inaugurated a concept of the state which is unique in human history. And it is here, then, see, this in a way could be subordinate to number one. All the rest really follows from number one. In other words, the civil authority is from God. First, that it's distinct from the church, and that it which is distinct is nevertheless from God. And therefore, Augustine points out at length obedience takes on a new dimension. Because even though the ruler is a pagan, as the Romans certainly were, yet if his authority is from God, you look beyond the holder of the office and you see God's authority itself. And there he says, and he asks, what other nation has shown this except Rome, which is getting away literally with murder, in fact with murderers, and doesn't know why? Well, didn't know, because by that time, of course, Christianity had come out of the open. But at least didn't know why. Rome was thinking it was powerful. No. It was in contact with a new entity in human history. Obedience, therefore, to God, even though the society is pagan and is, as it was in pagan times, persecuted. Right.
Well, maybe I'm going ahead of my own time, but this whole thing changes, this whole concept.
What changes?
So, obedience, in other words, you define what legitimate authority means.
No, it doesn't change. It doesn't change, it's still legitimate authority.
But there's a right of rebellion. Aquinas, at least is what I have of Aquinas, is that you can, if, you know, if it's a despot, you have the right to rebel.
Well, they might have done it too, as a matter of fact, had they had any prospect, you might say, of success, if they actually had established the state. But they had not established the state. There is a development, Mike, but not media contradiction. We'll see. We'll see Aquinas. Then laws. A second thing which Christianity brought into the scene, Augustine points out, something way beyond what human history had known before, is not only the fact that you have an authority which, if it is from God, is to be obeyed, even when it is nasty, so to speak, but the laws which are now obeyed are clarified, or can be clarified, under the impact of Christianity. So in other words, the scope of civil law, which is mainly found in its laws, is widened and deepened and clarified in the light of Revelation. Take, for example, a simple thing which looks simple to us. We don't find it strange at all that when the Mormons, good, sincere people, trekked across the country from Palmyra, New York, all the way to Salt Lake City, which they found in search of a haven, and they were meeting hostility all along the line because of their practice of polygamy. When they finally settled in Utah, where they had no trouble because they were the only ones there, it was just desert land, and when they finally developed and wanted recognition as a state, the federal government said, nothing doing, you can't become a state unless you give up polygamy. Give up polygamy. What? Our religion says there's a revelation on the subject. There may be a revelation. If you want to become American citizens, you give up polygamy. So they said, all right, we'll give up polygamy. So they gave up polygamy, verbally, nominally, but continued practicing it. So the federal government kept after the people in Utah and finally passed a law, this by the way is pertinent, passed a law disfranchising any polygamist, even though the state was recognized. So the Utahns challenged the constitutionality of that law. And no Utah jury would condemn a polygamist. Now finally, the Supreme Court declared unanimously that the law disfranchising polygamists is constitutional. And it, the Supreme Court, and what a difference, what happened in, is about 1890, the difference of 16 centuries since Roman paganism, which was polygamous, promiscuous, you name it. The Supreme Court declared that in our society, polygamy is outlawed because it is against the common good. It is against the principles on which this nation is founded. Now, the law, therefore, of the land was anti-polygamous. Of course, we're slipping back into paganism with other practices. But Augustine would say that the very concept of a monogamous society is a Christian concept, which, by the way, is not the concept in Pakistan, which happens to be Islamic. Their polygamy is not only permitted, it's on the law of the books. Now, of course, there are difficulties with polygamy for sheer lack of clientele. Nevertheless, monogamy as such would be two instances, one thing which is so obvious, where the laws of the state are changed, see, clarified, new concepts of morality brought in through the Christian revelation. Fourthly in the sequence there, since the coming of Christ and the Christian dispensation, and therefore the existence of the church, civil society is no longer what it can well be described as having been, a purely natural institution. In other words, God showers his grace not only on the church but through the church on civil society. So there are benefits accruing. They're not merely in terms of the laws come from Christian revelation, but in terms of the grace which is given also to civil society, so that civil society might enjoy peace and prosperity, which, if it deviates from Christian principles, it will lose. And that has been, as you know, the history even of Western thought. Fifthly, the concept of justice. Now, we're going to see that when we take up St. Thomas in detail, but just a word here. The idea of justice, of course, was already inbred in the old Roman law, as we'll see when we take up Aquinas. However, the notion of justice, especially as tempered, in Augustine's words, by charity, is something new on the political horizon. So it isn't just strict justice following the letter of the law. It is tempered by Christian charity. And to illustrate that, even in its extreme form, take a law like we have on the books in the United States requiring medical certification and approval, of course, by a medical examining board for anyone who will practice medicine in the United States. Well, that stands to reason. It's a good, just law. Otherwise, all kinds of shysters would be practicing medicine and making money on people's sufferings. Well, there are exceptions to a law like that. You might wonder how reasonable those exceptions are, but nevertheless, in view of certain people who don't believe in the art or science of medicine, notably the Christian scientists, by now all of our 50 states, all 50 states have an exception to the law of medical certification. A Christian Science practitioner is exempt from any kind of medical education, and he can practice his art of, call it, mental healing. Now, it's a rather extreme example. What I'm saying is, there is a respect, you might say, for the rights of a minority. There is a concern for rights of conscience here. Even though you might say the scientists should not have been given the exception. At any rate, the monolithic Roman law, see, do this or else suffer the consequences, has been greatly modified and mollified, softened by exceptions, by degrees, by tempering of punishment and so on due to Christian charity.
I wonder if this, what you're talking about the Christian science, I wonder if this is due to Augustine and Jefferson.
To Augustine or Jefferson? Mm-hmm. Well, you'll be surprised when we take up Bellarmine. I have the lineup of Bellarmine on one side and Jefferson on the other. Mike, you'll be surprised how much Jefferson unwittingly owed to his Jesuit forebear.
Did you read Bellarmine?
If not Bellarmine, he certainly read Locke, who read Bellarmine heavily.
Well, Thomas Jefferson, law of what's the name of He read a Frenchman who wrote the
Rousseau.
Yeah, Rousseau's that's where he read.
So did I.
Yes, well, he read, Jefferson read a lot of things.
I know, he read Italian, not too well.
No, his idea, at least we'll find out, that he is reading the late medieval contribution, say, to America, and the concept of democracy is right smack and gone.
Please? Somewhat Rousseau's law. That's the issue, yes.
Social contract, actually.
I need to read the whole thing. What's it called? The God that gives attention.
Social contract.
Now, that's just a little part of it.
Well,
that's one
social contract isn't
wrote,
quite a.
But the whole thing is
the discourse
on the law. A discourse. He wrote a whole.
Discourse of the Civil War.
No, it's called Drop the Anarchy. At any rate, Rousseau was the founder of the Constitution.
We'll bring him to class on tomorrow, shall we?
All right. As long as anybody wants.
So the concept of justice as being tempered by Christian charity. He is a further contribution and a change that came into effect, which Augustine then explained. And by the way, in doing so, this is important, in doing so, he sold in many ways Christianity to his contemporaries. Then the purpose. Now these two are tied together. In other words, we are prior to the coming of Christianity. The state may well be said to have been an end in itself. And its purpose was for the sake of the state. As evidenced in the wars and whatnot they were waging, and normally for the aggrandizement of a national or empirical power. Whereas here the purpose of the state became subordinate to a higher purpose, which was spiritual. So that while it has its own built-in purpose, which is temporal welfare of the people, that is to be subordinate to their spiritual welfare, and not vice versa. In fact, the major conflict between the Christians and the Roman Empire was right here. As you know, the Romans persecuted and put to death the Christians, perhaps from their own viewpoint, sincerely. Their logic was, they couldn't imagine, nor did they ever believe, that a person could worship other gods or another god than, say, the Roman ones, and yet be a good citizen. They had so entwined and identified church and state that anyone who was not a good pagan Roman or Roman pagan, they couldn't conceive of being a good Roman citizen. And the repeated protests of the fathers of the church, we will obey you in spite of the fact that if we don't worship your gods, that fell pretty much on deaf ears. And consequently, this idea of not subordinating the spiritual, making it just a tool of the material or temporal welfare of the state, is a Christian concept. And by the way, modern totalitarian states are just the opposite. Regularly, fascist Italy, Nazi Germany, to cite two modern examples. And finally, while Augustine doesn't go into it that much because he didn't face any of the problems that came into existence later on, yet he did believe there should be a relationship of assistance of whom to whom, well, the one to the other, not excluding, and here we can bring in the Donatists, not excluding the assistance of the state in suppressing the opposition raised by the Donatists. Now, I have a quotation which is a bit startling because he says even more than just now, for example, using the state 470 I have, 470 quotation. It's a very unusual thing. It goes on for a page and a half almost.
470.
That's his number 470, not page, in Augustine's synthesis. Read the whole thing. This is one of his letters in the height of the Donatist system. Now, in context, he is going even beyond what we just said before. He is saying here not merely the fact that civil power may be used to suppress or control the Donatists, but he says somehow civil power may be used to bring them back to their original religious allegiance. I quote, page 275. Originally, this is after quite a build-up. Originally, my opinion was that no one should be coerced into the unity of Christ, that we must act only by words, fight only by arguments, and prevail only by force of reason, lest we should have those whom we knew to be about heretics feigning themselves to be Catholics. But this opinion of mine was overcome not by the words of those who controverted it, but by conclusive examples to which they could point. And if you want to read the context, this is one of many letters. Now, what's behind it? Behind it, of course, is first generation people who fell away from the unity of the church. By this time, the state had become Catholic. It was, to all intents and purposes, a Catholic state. There was union of church and state to such an extent that, as and insofar as there was a breach in religious unity, there was a corresponding break in political unity. And once the Donatists had made, as they did make, a breach in Christian unity, they caused a chain of breaks in political unity, which, as a matter of fact, brought on all kinds of later consequences, not excluding the success of the Vandal invasions, but especially of the Muslim control and simply absorption of North Africa and the Near East. Now, if to us in modern times this sounds strange, well, we've got to see it in context, and I see in context it is a defensible proposition. Given, in other words, a union of church and state in which one is cause of the other, if people who, and of course judgment have to be made, people who broke with Christian unity, and as Augustine charged them time and again, for the sake of their own personal advantage, to say that they could not be, this is Augustine, to say they could not be required to keep from practicing or indulging in their schismatic practices would be to allow the state to disrupt, as a matter of fact, in time, there were sporadic efforts to control the Donatists, but by that time, by the time it happened, in the 7th century, Islam had become strong enough to really devastate and, for all practical purposes, remove Christianity from Africa and most of the Near East. Mike.
Well, then we justify the Roman persecution. I mean, on the same basis, because it was the opposite. Therefore, in the state, and the fact that the religion was threatened, the state was
threatened. But he was writing that we had first-generation Donatism, when, in other words, people themselves had broken away from Christian unity, saw the evil effects caused by their own insistence. So I'm quoting Augustine, right? And as you probably know, this is not condemning him. I'm saying that he has a point which has to be taken account of. But to fully understand all that's got to be said, you should read the Donatists. Schism. There's just much too much to it. By the way, the best place to find at least the letters of Augustine dealing with this is Hugh Pope's Life of Augustine. Hugh Pope's Life of Augustine, which has his letters. A long chapter on civil society and the church or Christianity. One, he changed his mind. He just saw the thing wasn't getting anywhere. And if the state has a right to its own peace, it must somehow implement that peace. He struggled with the idea, Mike. He struggled with it.
Well, I didn't think he would.
Well, now the teaching of Aquinas on civil society. We'll just begin this. Now here we want to elaborate on the rule of a commission unit.